Thank you, everyone. And we are calling the House Transportation meeting to order, and it is 20 minutes after 2 on March 4th, 2014. And let the record show that we have Representative Johnson, Representative Lynn, Representative Gaddis, Vice Chair Representative Isaacson, and myself, Representative Wilson. And our recording secretary is Nancy Hemingway. Our LIO monitor is Sam, and Becky Rooney is my, who just went out the door, is my committee aide. And before we start, please turn off your cell phones and put them on, or put them on airplane mode. So now we are going to go ahead and hear House Bill. What is it? House Bill 271. And Representative Isaacson, would you like to introduce your person that is going to? Actually, let me explain that a little bit, first of all. Paul Matz is going to be our, he's from the University of Fairbanks, and I do not plan on moving this bill out today, but we are having this today because Representative Isaacson wants to have Mr. Matz to go ahead and explain. He feels that he can explain it much better than anyone else.
And if I may, by introduction.
Okay, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is, I really appreciate the honor of being able to have this possible rail extension, at least the methodology and the plan for it presented today. I think it's very important for us to get it on the record why this is so important. The need to diversify our economy, as we mentioned the last time this bill was heard, can be helped, greatly aided by the railroad extension. When I was a mayor in North Pole, and we have a lot of the railroad, historically we've had a lot of the freight on the railroad in North Pole, and now with the closure of Flint Hills, that freight has been diminished from a 55% of their revenues down to 15%, and now it's a question mark how much revenue will be provided to the railroad from operations in North Pole. So, but at the time I was mayor, and Pat Gamble, who is now president of the university, was president of the railroad, and he sat in my office, and I asked him, where should the railroad go? And I expected to hear him say, well, let's connect it to the lower 48, or let's get it out to Nome. But I was very surprised to hear him say, it absolutely needs to go north. And I saw him in the hall again today, and here in the Capitol, and he says, and I want to add to that story. He says, not only does it need to go north because of all the resources it develops and opens up, and the costs that are lowered to the communities, the people are able to have transportation year-round on an affordable passenger rail service as well as the heavy freight, but he said, when he was the president of the railroad, he spoke to the president of Conoco, and at that time he said the railroad will cost $5 billion to build, and he said the president of Conoco didn't even blink. Instead he said, yes, and we're expecting to spend at least $105 billion more of capital to extract oil on the North Slope. $5 billion was nothing to $105 billion in capital expenditures, which then would bring multitudes of billions of dollars to the state and to the economy.
Five. Is he stealing your?
No.
No. This is by way of introduction. $5 billion, Madam Chairs. We're going to hear what that will do as far as lowering the cost of transportation in multiple industries, and he'll touch on several. Chris Adenson, when he was president of the railroad, said the same thing. So Dr. Metz is here because we were asked whether or not this would be a universe a welfare to the university. And Dr. Metz himself has been involved, and he can touch on this, but he has been involved in multiple projects that have actually become operational. The Tanana Bridge over the that the legislature just helped to pay for. That was done through studies conducted by Dr. Metz. The Port McKenzie rail, which is now three-fifths of the way done, Dr. Metz has his hand in that. The G7G effort to bring the rail from Alberta all the way to Delta Junction, Dr. Metz's fingerprints are on this. He has been known for a long time in the mining and the geological engineering realm, and rail has been something that Governor Murkowski tasked him and others. So he is not speaking from a philosophic, empirical, or, you know, from on the hill, as it were. He is talking from real-world experience, so I'm glad that he's here, and I just wanted to make sure that this was on the record, and Dr. Metz is able to explain this very well for us. I'll be quiet and let him talk.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And Paul, do we call you professor?
No, please not.
So we will just let you go ahead and give your presentation, and you heard the other one. We were pretty informal. We do ask questions. Would you rather us ask the questions as we go along or wait until the end?
Please ask questions as you see fit, and we'll address them as best we can.
Okay. Thank you. Go right ahead.
And I'm here, and as Representative Isaacson said, we've been involved in this series of studies, and these were not academic exercises that began back in 2000, and this was a really good induction to put it in the context of all of the other rail investigations that have had an immediate impact on the economy of Alaska. The first one that was done, the study for the rail link from Eielson to Delta Junction, was a partnership with Lockheed Martin, who you just heard from, and several other engineering firms. And the Alaska-Canada Rail Link study that was released, phase one was released in 2007, was a joint effort with, again, Lockheed Martin, the HDR Engineering, which is the largest railroad engineering firm in the United States, and Van Horn Institute at the University of Calgary, which is an industry-funded group. It's not a part of the university per se. It's an industry-funded research, applied research group. So, have a context of this. The original Rails to Resources legislation that Senator Frank Murkowski had sponsored and was signed into law in 2000 was to look at the impact of a rail extension or rail extensions on the development of North Slope natural gas. And so we're actually going back, in the first few commissions were on extensions to the east and to the south, and now we're going back to the original basis for the most recent national level discussions on this subject. We're going to be talking about future, and there's two quotes here. What is yet to come is still uncertain. I love this quote from William Shakespeare, and the second one, the future ain't what it used to be, by Yogi Berra. What in the relation that these two guys have together? Well, they're both talking about two aspects of the of future events. First of all, the future is uncertain, and second is we make projections today, and in the future they are going to be different than what we expect today. 40 years ago, we would have expected that the pipeline that was in the process of being built was going to be built faster than it was, and that it would last, in our collective wisdom, forever. And we know that that's not the case. And so even though there's uncertainty about the future and there's uncertainty with respect to the quality of our projections about the future, that shouldn't prevent us from looking forward instead of backwards. Alaska's future is tied to the oil patch, and it will be for a very, very long time. The major source of oil revenues began in 1977, and now we see that they're dwindling very, very rapidly. But there's still enormous resources on the North Slope, at least 40 billion plus barrels of conventional oil that is yet to be produced, and probably something in excess of 100 billion barrels of unconventional oil. The petroleum resource and reserves are two concepts that are often confused. The petroleum resource is something that might be potentially useful. A petroleum reserve is one that can be produced under current economic conditions using current technologies. And so a very large portion of our resources on the North Slope are resources, and to convert those to reserves is going to entail large capital investments by the private sector. And for that to happen, we have to have a competitive economic climate to produce those resources. There's a huge surge in petroleum production in the continental states in 2011 and since, on a technology that was first patented in 1947, the concept of hydrofracking, pumping fluids in the ground, breaking the rocks, and increasing the porosity of the source beds for both oil and gas. Today, the Bakken in North Dakota and Montana and Eagle Ford in Texas are producing large quantities of oil, and there are large quantities of natural gas being produced in the eastern states, the Marcellus Shale and other units. The West Texas oil field that produced about 35 billion barrels of oil, larger than the historic production of crude oil, was estimated in 1980 by the Carter administration to contain 100 billion barrels of oil in the source beds. Those source beds projected to the surface would cover an area of about 10,000 square miles. The Shoebreck Formation, one of the source beds in the North Slope, covers an area or underlies an area of about 30,000 square miles. So it's the size of the country of Ireland, and it is three times larger than the West Texas. So we have tremendous potential resources on the North Slope, but we've got to change those resources into reserves. Hydraulic fracturing has only been conducted on the North Slope in relatively small levels for really investigatory purposes rather than major production. And the reason for that is there's high cost of operations on the North Slope. Wells produced by fracking shale units do not have the same levels of productivity as conventional oil reservoirs, and they have much higher costs. So the margins are much narrower.
I'm going to stop you right here and ask a question. You said because high costs up there, and also it says including our high tax rates.
Historic tax rate.
Okay. Now, I'm going to ask you, in your opinion, Senate Bill 21, do you think that that's important?
It's absolutely important. It's absolutely essential that we reduce the taxes to make them more competitive, and you'll see a slide here very shortly to that, addressing that.
Thank you.
The consequence, there's been no surge in oil production on the North Slope with respect to fracking. And another quote here that I really like is from Winston Churchill: as a pessimist sees difficulty in every opportunity, and the optimist sees an opportunity in every difficulty. And that's what we really, a pessimist never drilled a mine, never drilled an oil well, never produced anything of significance. And this is what the historian Kenneth Clark, how he defines civilization versus periods of dark ages, is one that was optimism about the future. You have to be optimistic about the future. The Arctic oil bonanza that never occurred. There's a lot of misconceptions about this huge oil patch on the North Slope, and one of them is that it produced huge rates of return to the oil and gas industry. And in a very interesting and well-written discussion, John Miller in 2010 demonstrated that the Atlantic Richfield Company that found oil on a slope could have made a higher rate of return by putting their money in federal bonds, risk-free bonds, than they did from operating on the North Slope. And that was due to the high cost of operations and the extensive delays. It took less time when a decision was made to put a man on the moon. It took less time to do that than it did to get a permit to build the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline.
What a shame.
Constraints on northern oil and natural gas development, as I said earlier, high cost. Well, those aren't just words from me or from the oil and gas industry. The high cost of operations on the North Slope are well documented by the Defense Department. I worked for 6 years for the Air Force. I was just in the Air Force for 6 years. And what I did is cost out projects all over the state and in Greenland and elsewhere. And what we found is that the cost indices for the North Slope were extremely high. And this is due to long supply lines, remote areas, extreme environmental conditions. And when we add on top of that high tax burdens relative to the tax burdens that occur in other jurisdictions, we're producing a huge economic hurdle that has been very difficult for people to overcome, including ARCO. Reducing oil taxes has been an essential and necessary first step in this process. Developing a railroad to the North Slope to handle large volumes of bulk commodities, low unit cost materials, will have an enormous impact on that cost differential between the North Slope and others areas of oil production in North America. In addition, that railroad will have a backhaul capability, a new concept for the railroad, having a backhaul of mineral concentrates south to ports in south central Alaska for export around the world. So as part of these studies, I developed an ArcGIS-based freight forecast system that's been published in the Transportation Research Board and been given in a number of conferences. It's not an academic exercise. It's a really important, fundamental exercise in determining what you're going to haul on this rail system that you plan to build or pipeline system or any other transportation system. And here shows the proposed corridor from Nenana, or the little siding just north of Nenana, at Dunbar, to Prudhoe Bay. And for all of our studies, we looked at what would be the impact of this corridor on the mineral resources within 50 miles on either side of that transportation corridor. The idea that mine owners would fund either rail spurs or road connections to the rail corridor in which to transport materials out and resupply in. From Nenana to Prudhoe Bay, in that 100-mile-wide corridor, there's over 600 known mineral occurrences. There'd be a lot more if there was a railroad system there because there'd be a huge incentive to do that exploration. Well, let's just quickly look at these cost factors. In some of these slides, I'm going to go through fairly quickly. You have them in front of you, and the arithmetic you can follow later. It's very simple. The North Slope, of course, all of the DOD facilities there are closed down, but these numbers didn't change very much from the time I worked there in the late 60s and early 70s to the present, relative factors. The cost of operations on the Aleutians are about the same, and we're the same, and are would be the same today, about between 4 and 4.5 times what they are in the continental United States. The index is based on an average of all DOD contracts nationwide, construction contracts nationwide. So it gives us an index of what it costs relative to the lower 48. So if we look at where fracking is occurring elsewhere in East Texas or the state of Texas on the average, the cost of North Slope relative to East Texas is about 6.5 times, relative to the state of Texas as a whole is about 5 times. So these aren't percentages. These are factors of times. These are huge, huge cost differentials. So let's just look at a quick scenario here on what might be the benefits and the cost of this rail extension. Great Bay Petroleum in 2012 announced that they would like to drill 200 wells a year on the North Slope, applying horizontal drilling and hydrofracking to produce oil from the Shublik Formation and other source beds on the North Slope. Looking at these quantities, the depth of the Shublik versus the shale units in the Bakken and the Eagle Ford, the remote locations and the need for servicing these wells, I've estimated those 200 wells a year would require about 12,000 tons of freight per well, or 2.5 million tons a year. Well, that's 2.5 times the amount of concentrates that are hauled out of Red Dog every year, and it's right near Tidewater. So this is a huge amount of freight that would have to be sent north. It would be equivalent to 500-car trains, which would carry 10,000 tons per train, 5 of those a week, 52 weeks a year, or roughly 168 18-wheelers that could legally carry 40 tons, which they can't always, per day going one way. And so we're talking about enormous volumes of freight that would be huge traffic volumes on the Dalton Highway. And that doesn't include, of course, the backhaul that might occur from the development of these mineral resources. I added here a map just to show you, everyone, of course, knows the geography of Alaska, but to remind you that there's another very large oil resource to the east at the Mackenzie River Delta, and there are huge oil resources offshore to the northwest, as well as very large coal resources on the North Slope that all would benefit from this rail connection.
One question.
Representative Isaacson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, boy. I'm not feeling well. She knows it. So the question has come up before. Why not bring the rail, just say, from Dead Horse to maybe the Brooks Range or something? Why do we need to take it all the way from Nanana or Fairbanks all the way up there? Can it be done differently and still achieve the same benefit if you are freighting it, say, getting it onto water up at Dead Horse or something?
Actually, what we're talking about is connecting this rail to Huntsville, Alabama, eventually. Putting the drilling steel on a rail car, running it across the country, putting on a rail barge, or rail marine barge system, bringing it into South Central Alaska, and then delivering it to the North Slope. Yes, we could avoid building a tunnel under Attigan Pass, bringing the rail that far, but then you'd have to offload that material and handle it again, put it on a truck, haul it to the North Slope, and then unload it again. And so the thought that a tunnel under Attigan Pass is a daunting exercise, it really isn't.
Now, where on this map is Attigan Pass?
It's, as you see that little highway number there.
Yes.
Just north of Coldfoot.
Uh-huh.
That's Attigan Pass.
Okay.
You'll get a little better view.
And this would be a corridor. When you were talking about the mineral possibilities, that was just 50 miles on each side.
That's an arbitrary width that we've estimated is what a moderate-sized mine could probably bear the cost, the capital cost of a road. If it was a very, very large mine, then it might bear the cost of a rail over that distance. But there is a utility corridor north of the Yukon River that has been set aside as federal land that is designated as a transportation corridor. And we often forget about that. I did an assessment for the Bureau of Mines of all the mineral sources in that corridor that were known back in 1975, 76, and 77. In places that corridor is 18 miles or three townships wide.
Okay.
Well, just to look at this is just a couple of quick photos to see the terrain. What you're looking at here is some brown dirt that's north of Livengood in the Hess Creek area from Livengood to the Yukon River. Some very challenging permafrost conditions, some areas of very high relief, very steep slopes. I've driven to the north slope during the pipeline construction and we're actually doing that assessment. Left Fairbanks and never saw anything but taillights until I got to Prudhoe Bay. That's how tough the road system was at that time. As we go further north, of course, the relief gets even higher in the central part of the Brooks Range. And as we go up the Chandelier Shelf here, we see extreme grades, the 13-14% grades, and then it gets even higher as we go up over Attigan Pass.
And when you're in a semi, that just is pretty scary.
It is. And then, of course, getting back down the other side in Attigan Valley here and then on to the North Slope, pulling the grade out of near Pump 4 at Galbraith Lake. Very challenging grades and permafrost conditions. And the route that I've laid out, we've tried to utilize the braided stream valleys as best as possible and keep that alignment at nearly a horizontal grade at 1%. Okay, well, let's just look at the difference that the freight would be for rail versus truck and the cost differential there. At 12,000 tons per well, just the cost from Fairbanks, 170 miles at $1 a ton mile, that would add the cost to the well about $5.5 million. From Dunbar, or just north of Prudhoe, to Prudhoe's 450 miles, a little bit shorter because it's a great stretch, reach due north from Nenana. At 0.1 a ton mile, the cost there would be about $550,000. The cost, this analysis, this benefit cost analysis, isn't from the point of view of the oil companies or the trucking industry. It's from the point of view of the state. So what we really need to do is look at what is the cost of this project and what are the revenues that are going to accrue to the state of Alaska. Now, obviously, there's going to be some huge benefits that will accrue to the oil industry from reducing their freight costs. There'll be huge benefits to the trucking industry because there'll be more revenue in the treasury and more economy in the state as a whole, and a lot more freight being shipped elsewhere in the state in addition to Prudhoe Bay. So what I've done here is I used the unit cost that we got from our previous studies of about $6 million a mile for that 450 miles that I've laid out. Actually, we had a route map that we've nearly completed on this already. I looked at a tunnel at those brown rocks south of the Yukon River, terrible rocks that with those steep grades, it's easier to tunnel through them. If you've ever driven the Dalton Highway, you'll know that the Yukon River Bridge is at a 7% incline. It's that way because of those basaltic rocks. It's just south of the river. So you have to tunnel through those. And what I use for unit cost of that tunnel is we don't have a recent tunnel being constructed in the state, but I used the unit cost of a very long, very expensive, very deep tunnel that's almost finished in a very high cost area of the Alps. And that unit cost of $2.5 million a mile, I think, is very excessive. But it makes for a very conservative estimate of this project cost. But at even pass, we would be looking at a longer tunnel of about 4.5 miles. The tunnel in the Alps is 57 kilometers long, and it's over 1,000 meters deep. And so we're talking about a much easier tunneling project, even at Attigan Pass, than the tunnel across, the rail tunnel across the Alps, the new one that's near completion. The Yukon River Bridge, I estimated that at $500 million, and I think that's extremely conservative as well. The original bridge that was built there was about $31 million, the highway bridge. Obviously, isn't going to service a railroad. So I think my costs here are very conservative, and what we've got is something in the neighborhood of $5.2 billion, including provisions for a terminal on the North Slope. The benefits to accrue to the state, if we assume that the only benefits the state got from this whole project would be 1/8 royalty in that 200 wells that Gregory has proposed drilling a year. That was the only benefit. At $85 a barrel, our 1/8 royalty would generate about $1.5 billion a year. 200 wells, 2,000 barrels a day would fill up the pipeline, it would fill up the treasury, and with the potential resource that we have in the North Slope, that would last for a very, very long time. So let's look at the benefit-cost analysis, and which the bottom line is here, even if we had a required rate of return at 10%, the benefits to the cost are 2.5 times, assuming the only benefit is that royalty oil. If we looked at a just similar rate of return on investment, 30%? Well, guess what? Warren Buffett, when he bought the BNSF Railroad, last year the transportation index went up 30%. So he, I don't think this rate of return is astronomical compared to what is happening in the contiguous states. 60% of the oil that's being transported out of the Bakken's is by rail. Huge amounts of oil are being transported around the world by rail, and we haven't even considered that in this analysis. Way to fund this? We're not going to tap the budget. We're not going to tap the capital budget or the state's budget at all. What the state can do is use the bonding authority of the Alaska Railroad to sell non-recourse revenue bonds, and this is where the wake-up call to make a decision on the project would occur. Those revenue bonds can only be sold if the state of Alaska or the Alaska Railroad in particular could sign long-term contracts guaranteeing that it had a revenue stream to pay those non-recourse revenue bonds back. And so this would be a no-go, go decision point. To get there, what we have to do is we have to complete a business case that will defend this $5.2 billion capital estimate to the financial community to whom we wish to sell those bonds. And we need to provide that business case to the Surface Transportation Board, which is the agency of authority for all railroad extensions in the United States. So what this $2 million is proposed for is to add to the money that it's been expended so far to bring this analysis up to not a bankable feasibility study, but a defendable business case that can be submitted to the Surface Transportation Board. When we compare this cost to other costs of other feasibility studies, we look at the cost of the feasibility study for some of you that have been here a long time. Remember the quartz hill project, the quartz hill molybdenum project in southeastern, in near Ketchikan. That project had the cost of that feasibility study was $100 million. The cost of the feasibility study to reopen the AJ mine a few years ago by Echo Bay Mines was $100 million. These large capital-intensive projects have to have detailed engineering studies to justify the long future projections that we make about the sources of revenues, to deal with those uncertainties, to make sure that what we predict today will have a reasonable chance of occurring in the future. Other mineral sources, and I'm not going to belabor this one, the long and the short of this slide is that the cost of trucking mineral concentrates from the Brooks Range or other low unit value commodities from the North Slope is too high to justify the development of those projects. The only way these base metal occurrences, like in the copper in the Ambler Schist Belt, or other lead zinc deposits. I had a contract years ago to look at the potential for lead zinc mineralization in the Galbraith Lake area of the Central Brooks Range, similar to what we see at Red Dog. The only way that that resource will ever be exploited will be if there's a rail extension to the North Slope. So, in summary, the logistics for the North Slope, the challenges there can be addressed in part by the railroad, in a very large part. This will give us year-round transportation access to the state's major asset. And that is going to be not something that's going to occur tomorrow. These large projects, the rail extension from Eielson to Delta Junction, I started that in 2003. We didn't have the bridge done until 2013. It took 10 years just for that blank bridge. When we talk about building this whole North Slope project, we should be looking at building it now when that natural gas pipeline is ready to be built so we can haul that pipe up there and help develop the gas fields on the North Slope. Possibly bring gas liquids from Point Thompson back south. But again, that's not included in the analysis. And I warrant here that without a rail extension to the North Slope, it's very unlikely that we're going to see major oil shale or shale gas development on the North Slope. Thank you.
Any questions?
Madam Chair, if no one else
Representative
does.
Isaacson.
Thank you. So I just want to highlight a couple of the mechanics. Again, you said, Paul, that in order for us to actually start a project like this, it is necessary for us to go through certain steps. This feasibility study or proof of concept or business concept is actually the first step, and then you go to, say, someone like the National Transportation Service Board, and they shed some money for the environmental study, and then it comes to the state's responsibility then to actually see the project done. Am I saying this right? And give us a timetable.
Everything except for the STB isn't. There's only a couple dozen guys, gals on that board, and they don't have much of a budget. They're not going to fund that EIS. And we could think about what, in terms of that's the next step. We do the business case, STB takes it over, but someone's got to fund that EIS. The EIS for the Eielson to Delta Junction was $20 million. Senator Stevens provided the first 15 after I was half done with that project. We gave him the preliminary report and he said, let's do it. They had to pony up another $5 million later. But generally, the EIS for major projects ranges from 2 to 3% of the capital cost as well. So we're not talking about a trivial amount of money after the business case is made. Now, Norway has a very novel way of approaching oil and gas development. They do the preliminary, if you would, science through funding seismic surveys. Then they take the responsibility for completing the environmental impact statements, and then they tender this out to the private sector. So we could think about doing something similar to that here, including in that bonding the cost of the EIS. But so the EIS would be funded by the same revenue bonds. The caveat there is, if you do that, there's always the uncertainty that the project will be delayed, and with that, the cost will escalate as a function of delays.
But aren't they? I mean, Norway is a country, and so if the country wants to do something, they can do it easier than a state that has to have permission from our federal government. There's a difference there.
That is a difference. But as I said, the quote from Winston Churchill.
So being follow-up?
Representative Isaacson.
Thanks. So being optimistic and not pessimistic, we need to start this now. So what are the downsides? Right now, in your if we were to be able to fund this study and get this going, the business case then would include talking to folks like those 685 mineral occurrences, notably Great Bear, notably perhaps even Conoco and some of these others, Nova Copper, others in the Ambler, to prove up the case that, and maybe then to invite them into participating in sharing the expense. Am I right in this part? Or?
Yeah, actually, you're right. That needs to be done right up front. All the potential freight hauler or customers should be contacted and included in this analysis, and at least letters of intent or letters of goodwill that should this be built, they would utilize that facility. And then when you go from the EIS, then when you do the final feasibility study and sign those, if you would, have an open season, that is a firm commitment.
So, Madam Chair, if I could suggest this is something that I would ask for us to take up as a priority. Maybe this, the bill as written, needs to be changed a little bit to be able to get out of committee. But I would certainly invite support of the committee for this project. As you can see, it does hold a tool to help the state down the road in development and the people of the state for jobs and goods and services at a much reduced rate. This is one of the things that can take us on in for decades to come. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I have a question for you. Now, you worked with the G7G and group, and they're really wanting to have something happen too, and so we could even have possibilities of other countries helping us out.
Oh, absolutely. The G7G discussion was really started. That was the Alberta government that provided the money. The Alberta government, although they didn't participate in the Phase 1 Alaska-Canada Rail Link study, were involved. The Van Horn Institute at the University of Calgary was part of one of our partners on that 2007 study, and they're actually the entity that's managing that $1.8 million that the Alberta government put forward for the oil sands feasibility study.
Well, they're actually, they approached us at Penwar last time and are really trying to push something right now. And so it's still something that they are very interested in.
That's correct. We have a small portion of that contract, as Representative Isaacs mentioned.
Okay. Well, any other questions from anyone? I guess you'll have to start working on your bill and see if you can get enough support so that we can bring it up again. So next, this coming Thursday, we will have a joint meeting with the Senate, and that's going to be on the big mega projects, the Ambler Road and the Juneau Access Road, I think those two. So that will be coming up on Thursday. So until then, we will, I think we start at 1:30 that day?
No, 1.
1? Okay. All right, so then we'll see you at 1 on Thursday, and this meeting is adjourned.